Passing around this little notebook and have each of you take one page and jot down whatever question about meditation or about the book comes to you. And while we're doing a meditation early on, I'll have a chance to look at what it is you've jotted down. That way, instead of my simply presenting a spiel to you, there will be some degree of dialogue, some degree of communication. I'm firmly committed to the notion that communication, which is primarily monologue, tends to be limited. And if there's some back and forth, then we tend to have a greater actual chance to communicate. So I'll pass the tablet around now, and in a minute or so I'll pass this around, and you can put whatever you've written on the tablet, and I'll say a few words as you are doing that. Let's see here. You can start with the tablet. And I will. These are completely anonymous. When I bring them out, I'll read them. So if you have questions that you've been wondering about for a long time regarding meditation, if there's something that's very personal and you'd like to ask it or you'd like to say it, but you don't particularly want people to know that it's you, well, they won't know that it's you. It'll just be one of the questions that I'm reading. When I have done talks about the book before, sometimes I have talked about the book, and sometimes I have talked primarily about people's own experiences of meditation, their own difficulties, their own adventures with it, whatever. And I am willing to go in whatever direction your questions suggest. Whatever it is, it seems to be most valuable to you. I figure, basically, I'm here for you, not you're here for me. I will also pass around the something which is out of, you know, we former professors and professors always have handouts and things. Even in digital age, it's hard to get over it all. So the title of the book is called Matrix Meditations, and one of the reasons for that is that the book is not divided into the usual kinds of chapters. There are 10 brief introductory chapters, and the introductory chapters are a combination of my perspective as a psychologist, so you'll find more here about what are the psychological dynamics of meditation, of what underlies it, how does it actually work, what's going on when a person meditates. You'll find much more there than you will in most books on meditation. And then you'll also find the other perspective coming in, which intermingles with it throughout the book, that my wife brings. She's an intuitive. She really comes. She comes much more from the heart. I come more from the head. And so we meet and mingle throughout the pages of this. So we've got the brief introductory chapters, and then the rest of it is structured. How many of you are familiar with the I Ching or the I Ching? Yeah, well, this is set up much like the I Ching. It has 65 cells rather than 64. The first cell, zero, is breath, because every moment we breathe, and if we weren't breathing, we wouldn't be here. And then the rest of it, you can take a look, and you'll have an opportunity to say, well, I'd like to hear a little bit about this or that or the other thing. So the balance of the book, the 65, each one of these cells is relatively brief. Here, you can start it this time. And each one of the cells has a little picture at the beginning. This particular picture happens to be lava flowing over the middle of a road in Big Island in Hawaii, and the title of the cell is Limits. And you're very limited in how far you can go along that road. And we tried to do that with all of the chapters, to have a photograph that was keyed to the cell. And then there's about something like the neighborhood of 3 pages or so of commentary on the particular topic that you find there. And then there is a practice. And the practices are divided into 4 categories. There are mindfulness practices, of which we just did a very brief one at the very beginning. There are concentrative practices. I tend to like to say the that most people's minds are, you can imagine your mind as being a circle, and draw a line down the middle of that circle, and half of our minds, half of most people's minds, and this is generalizing to say most people, but half of most people's minds are available to focus on whatever it is that they're doing and need to do, and the other half are like a whole bunch of little arrows darting in all sorts of different directions, thinking of this, the other thing, etc., that thing that I need to do, that thing that I was supposed to do, the troubling thing that's on my mind. And so that half of our mind is not available to deal with whatever is occurring in the present. So we have half our wits available. So I tend to think that most people are essentially half-wits. And that's part of what meditation is about, is the concentrated meditation is about taking that, like if I reached for another metaphor for just a moment, that half is like looking at the window in the front of a washing machine with a whole lot of the clothes going in all kinds of directions and a whole lot of arrows going here and there. A concentrated meditation can move those arrows more slowly, get them moving in the same direction, bring focus and more of your attention. It's concentrated meditation is about learning to manage, guide, and control your meditation. By becoming more effective in concentrated meditation, you become able to become more effective in your mindfulness meditation. Oh, I'm noticing rather than getting lost. The third form of meditation that we deal with here is reflective meditation. So you'll see some of those cells there look fairly topical. I even did have a copy of that myself. Thanks. There are things like apology, gratitude, trust, difficulties. Some of those things are reflections. And so reflective meditations are meditations that allow a person to sit with, in a guided way, that particular aspect of their existence, and to go into it, to deepen it in a sense. In a reflective meditation, actually, in some ways, is analogous to some of what you can do in psychotherapy. There are actually some processes that operate very similarly in terms of being brought out in a psychotherapeutic or counseling context, or bubbling up while sitting quietly. Oh yes, things from many, many years ago. Apology. I remember a bad thing I did to a person a long time. I remembered one time I was sitting in meditation and all of a sudden I remembered when I had been in college and borrowed somebody's motor scooter, and his and my girlfriend and I went on it, and it was too heavy a load, and I gave it back to him in less than optimal working condition and blamed it on the motor scooter instead of on what we'd done. Oh, well, there are lots of these things sort of lurking around. And then there are also beautiful reflective meditations, which take us into love, beauty, places of that sort. And then finally, everyday awareness practices, things that you can do in the middle of everyday life, in the middle of wherever and whatever you happen to be doing. Would you like to do one little awareness practice that takes maybe a minute or a minute and a half right now? This is one of the shortest and simplest ones that you can do, but there are others that are I consider walking meditations to be in the category of everyday awareness practices, because they're things you can do every day. All right, here's what you do. This is called Just One Thing at a Time, and I'd like you to stand up, do something or other, and then sit back down in your normal everyday way. So I'm going to stand up and take my glasses off and put them down on the table here, and hit that little gong once, and then sit back down. Now I'd like to invite each of you to do the same thing. Not what I did, but whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. many of you can probably recall, either from some time back or maybe from this morning or this afternoon or yesterday, times when you were hurried and had several things that you were trying to do all at once, and as a result did all of them poorly, like fumbling for my car keys while trying to get something out of my backpack, and like several things at once. Is that a common experience? Ever done that? All right. This is a great practice for dealing with situations like that. Now I'd like you to close your eyes, mentally review what you just did, the physical action. Now you may open your eyes, and I'd like you to do the same thing again, or reverse what you did. In my case, I'll be putting my glasses back on, with one difference. This time, you will make just one movement at a time. So I will lean forward, I will bring my foot back to support my weight, I'll stand up. Now I invite you to do the same. Just one movement at a time. Physical movement you're concentrating on. Feel any different? So that's one of the things that we have actually in the beginning of the book. We have this is actually set up in multiple ways in which you can approach it. There's a chapter called Portals, which describes the various different ways in which you can use this. One of the ways is by looking at, here is a list of all the mindfulness meditations, the directory of meditations. There's a list of the concentrative meditations, a list of the everyday awareness practices, or adventures in awareness, we've called them, and a list of contemplative meditations. Maybe you don't like to sit still. Maybe you're one of those people who says, you know, meditation sounds great, but it's just not for me. I'm too active a person. Okay, start out with the everyday awareness practices. Start out with the things that you can do in action while you go along. You can find a way that suits you. We also have a structured program, a structured process that people who are new to meditation can follow. If you're an experienced meditator, you would probably want to look and find, what are some things that I've never run across before? Some advanced practices that will take me to new and different places, and you will find them there. So those are some of the ways that you can use this. You can also use it like the I Ching. You can throw three coins, only throw them three times instead of six. And then there's a little table that tells you what pages to go. And we even invented an alternative oracle, which is a playing card oracle. You can draw a deck from a deck of cards and then go to a table, which tells you which one of the cells to go to and see what it has to say to you as far as a message. Or, since you all know what all the decks are, what all the cards are, you can even imagine a card. You can pull a card from an imaginary deck and then do that. Now, what I would like to do, I'm noticing that I'm talking a lot and not leaving much space. I will send this bag around, and would you kindly each put whatever you've written down in it? If you need to hold it for a moment to finish putting it down, you can do that. But I'd like to get that back within a fairly short time with whatever questions you might have of any kind.
What happened in the awareness meditation?
What happened there?
You sort of left us.
The one that we just did. Oh, well, Basically, that's a focusing and slowing attention down to whatever. Usually, our attention is doing several things at once. And if my attention is doing several things at once, then I tend to do like multitasking. There's been considerable psychological research that shows that people who are engaged in doing a good deal of multitasking usually think that there's no decrement, there's no fall off in their performance in the different things that they're doing. But the research shows that they're wrong. That actually, when a person is engaged in multitasking, that most of the tasks that they're engaged in suffer to some degree or another. In everyday life, most people's troubles that they're having exist partly in the world and to a considerable degree in their mind. Most people are not very effective at being able to focus their mind and keep it in one place. So, for example, let's say you and I are having a conversation. And as in the course of the conversation, you're talking about something of importance to you, and I start replying to it, and I go off on a tangent that is interesting to me, and you end up following me off on my tangent without ever having noticed that, oh, we've lost completely what it was that you started out being concerned about, and I've taken you on my trip rather than staying on your trip. And so by developing the ability to consciously focus our attention, we also develop the ability to know where our attention is at any given moment. And in that same conversation, we could start off in the same way, and you could say to me, but wait a minute, what I'm concerned about is, let's go back to that, right? So you notice the way in which I'm taking you someplace else, and you bring me back to where it is that you want to go with your attention. If we're doing we do the same thing to ourselves that I just described that you and I can do together. So let's say that this is serving as a candle flame, Tritak, the oldest of all recorded forms of meditation in India. There are thousands of years ago, there are records of people sitting meditating on a candle flame. It was a favorite of Hari Shohar, one of my own favorite friends and meditation teachers for many years, Ayurvedic master. And Tritak is an apparently very simple form of meditation. It's simply, I concentrate on something, and when I notice that my mind has drifted somewhere else, then I bring my mind back to it. In fact, let's make it just a little more complex. Let's bring the vase of flowers up, and we'll come back to finishing your question in the process of finishing it by doing as well as just by talking.
Yes.
I'd like you all to look at this big bright rose in the beginning, and I'd like you to focus your meditation on it until I ask you to stop. And each time while you try to keep your attention completely on that rose, and whenever you notice that your attention has drifted away, bring it back to the rose. Don't try to keep things out of your meditation. That doesn't work. It just, then you become worried about what you're trying to keep out. Just when you notice that your mind is someplace else, bring it back. Or when you hear me go, that's a signal. Notice where my mind is. See if there's any important message for me there, like maybe a remembrance of something that I need to do tomorrow that I'd forgotten about. I certainly very often find in meditation remembering things that I need to do or have left undone, etc., comes up more often there than any other time. But then bring your attention back to the flower. And this is just noticing how much your attention drifts while you are keeping it on that flower for just a minute or so. In fact, notice your breathing at the same time that you notice the flower. Sense the air going in and out. And that's enough with the flower. Most people, and by most I mean 95%, there I am multitasking and spilling tea. Most people cannot keep their attention focused on the second hand of a watch or clock for 1 minute without their attention drifting away. However, it's a quality that can be cultivated. Tea. The Japanese tea ceremony is an exercise in one-pointedness. One time, my wife and I have seen a number of Japanese tea ceremonies in this country. One time we were fortunate enough to go to one in Kyoto, done by by the greatest tea master that I have ever seen. The boiling of the making of the tea, it's done in a special way with a little brush. Many of you probably are familiar with it. And there's a whole pattern, a whole ceremony in terms of boiling the water, making the tea, putting it into, and ultimately bringing it around and serving it to each person. The tea master does it with such single-pointed attention, with such one-pointedness, that it is riveting. Everything else ceases to exist except what she is doing at that particular instant. And this is all achieved not by any technique other than her complete and total attention to each moment of what she's doing. In Zen, they speak of one-pointed attention, many-pointed attention, or two-pointed attention. Concentrated meditation is essential, such as we did when we stood up and sat down. And what we did with the simple tray tack is essentially two-pointed attention, also called the witness in the Hindu traditions, the Vedic traditions. We have one part of your mind which is doing whatever it's doing, or one part of your mind, body, somatic self, is doing whatever it's doing, and then you detail another part of your attention to notice what that first part of your attention is doing. And by noticing, you then become more capable of keeping your attention where you want it, noticing where it is, etc. And you become more capable of mindfulness. You become more capable of noticing, oh, there I am being judgmental toward myself and saying, oh, how I screwed that up. Damn, how am I ever going to stop doing these crappy things, etc.? Or maybe it's other people. Maybe I'm judgmental or blaming. All you have to do is take a look at the sports or political commentaries online of almost anything, and 9 out of 10 of the commentaries are usually people trashing other people and being judgmental and blaming about them. Well, that is. Those are all things that interfere with our happiness, that interfere with our presence, our peace of mind. So the concentrated meditation deals with that. Any others, anything else anyone wants to give me here? Any other questions or comments regarding what we have done or said so far before I give you another little ask you to do another little task and read what you've written on your pieces of paper? Yeah.
What do you find that you are noticing that you're noticing? So therefore, when you're concentrating and looking at the flower, you are noticing that you are looking at the flower.
That's perfectly fine. You're just stepping each time. You're, in a sense, you're stepping behind yourself. And that stepping behind yourself is the essence of what among the Enraja Yoga is termed the witness, or is termed two-pointed attention. You're still working on you're still developing your ability to focus, your ability to be aware. Now, if you're doing that, you're not doing any of the 39, you're not noticing any of the 39 other things that you might be noticing. And that's good. Most of the time, because most of those 39 things are of no particular use to you. if we sit again quietly here right now, which I'm not going to do, but I'm just going to mention, if we sit for a moment and do no more than be aware of your physical sensations, hearing in your body, etc., then you would, in a short period of time, notice a number of things. Well, that's good too, because you're simply noticing what is occurring, noticing, but without one thing getting in the way of another. Where people get into trouble is their minds getting all confused and kind of cluttered up with each other, and also keeping things in separate categories. We spend huge amounts of energy keeping different areas of our lives. When I say we, I mean the average person, separate from each other, some more, some less, like someone who keeps their political beliefs and their religious beliefs and their technological beliefs and attitudes, etc., all in separate compartments. And those separate compartments are all related by virtue of okay, who's the authority that I accept all of this from? And the authority may tell me radically contradictory, radically different things, and I accept it all because it's all coming from the same authority. Or, similarly, there may be very traumatic and painful experiences that have happened to me in my life that I want to keep out of my awareness because I don't know how to handle them. When I was a little kid, I didn't know how to handle them. Suppose, for instance, that I got often beaten severely by my father. Didn't, fortunately, in my case. I got a few spankings, and that was all. But I, as a little kid, I don't know how to handle it. As a grown-up, I probably still haven't learned how to handle it. So I keep it out of my awareness. I push it out of my mind. Most of us have a whole variety of things. Some many, some few. One psychiatrist, Wilson Van Dusen, calls them holes in the personality. So one of the things that meditation does is provide a gentle way of allowing many of those events that we keep separated from each other to come into our consciousness, so that we can see them slowly and in a clear kind of way. I become aware, as I notice my own process right now, that I really confused two different questions, confused the answers to two different questions in terms of what I was answering to you there. One of them was your question about things getting caught up with each other, and the other was the opposite statement about how it is that we keep things separated and in mental categories that we don't allow ourselves to see. Okay. Let me take just before I look at these a brief poll. How many of you meditate regularly? That is at least several times a week. Okay. How many of you have never meditated or very seldom? Okay, great. We will engage in one little what I like to do as a starting sequence. Beginning meditation, and it will include one thing that you have probably never done before, that you will find to be valuable to you, that you can take away and use in the future, regardless of what meditative form you use, regardless of whether you use a Christian, a Buddhist, a Hindu or yogic or whatever form of meditation. We begin. Would you kindly begin with your feet about shoulder width apart, and one of the common terms that's used for people is that they're off balance when they're upset. You may feel off balance while you're upset. Maybe you already have a way of balancing. Maybe you're used to the typical Zen way of balancing. If you want to use that instead of the way that I'll describe, you can use that. What we're going to do is begin by finding our center in relationship to gravity. So if you don't have a different way that you want to do it, kindly close your eyes. Imagine that your head, the top of your head is suspended by a golden string that's attached somewhere about halfway between here and the moon. And allow yourself to move in a clockwise direction, inhaling during the back half. You're like a swinging pendulum. Move from your waist to the top of your body. Open your eyes for just a second and see what I'm doing. You're moving inhaling during the back half of the swinging pendulum, exhaling during the front half. You can also do this standing up, but we have to be sitting down now. So inhaling, exhaling, inhaling, exhaling. And then gradually let your circle become smaller and smaller. Let your circle, as it becomes smaller, your breathing is at the same rate, so your circle will slow down because you're still inhaling in the back half and exhaling in the front half. And then you will come to a point where you are perfectly centered in relation to gravity. Doing no more than this can often be valuable in daily life as a daily awareness practice, finding your balance in an unbalanced situation. Now, from this balanced situation, feel your breathing, sense your breath coming in and out. And you may either count one number on each breath, or if you have a mantra that you like, you can say your mantra on each breath. Say it on the inhalation and leave the exhalation empty, letting whatever has formed itself in your mind on the inhalation empty itself out on the exhalation. Now, as you continue to do what you're doing, I'd like you to form a mudra. I will describe three mudras. You can choose any of them you wish. This is a typical Buddhist mudra. Turn your palms upward, put them on your legs, and your thumb and either your first or second finger are touching, whichever is comfortable for you. Or you may prefer a Zen mudra, which is like this, front of your belly. Or you may have the invisible mudra, which is like this mudra turned upside down, which is very convenient if you happen to want to meditate in a crowded public space and you don't want to be conspicuous. Whichever mudra you have, as you inhale, allow your thumb and forefinger to separate by about a 16th of an inch or an 1/8 of an inch and to touch as you exhale. Separating as you inhale, touching as you exhale. This is a moving mudra, and it is one of a variety of things that you can add to your basic meditative stance that helps keep your attention focused in the present. So continue with your counting, or continue with your mantra as you do the separation as you inhale and the touching as you exhale of the moving mudra. And every time you hear the little gong, just notice where your attention has gone and bring it back to the meditation that you're doing with the moving mudra. Meanwhile, I'll have a chance to look at what you've written here. Inhaling, separating. Exhaling, touching. Okay, now allow yourself to move back into ordinary, everyday conversational consciousness, wherever you've gone. And I love the wonderful variety and collection of the items that you have written here. I'm going to start off with one that caught my attention right at the end. Is Irv Polster still working and alive? Irv Polster is a Gestalt therapist, and he may be, all things considered, the most capable Gestalt therapist who ever lived. He does different things than Fritz Perls, the founder of it, did, and he does very different things than some of the... Irv Polster, the answer to the question is that he is still working and alive, and not only that, but I happen to be co-presentation chair for next year's 2012 Gestalt Therapy Association for the Advancement of Convention in Puebla, Mexico, and we are, at my suggestion, giving Irv a Lifetime Contribution to Gestalt Therapy Award. We gave such an award to Philip Lichtenberg last year in Philadelphia, and so Irv will be the second person to get such an award. He just came back from Italy. He said, well, you know, I don't know if I can go to Mexico. I'm 90 years old now and getting along. And he came back and said, hey, I had a great time in Italy. It was a wonderful trip. Sure, I'll be glad to come. Can my wife come for free, come to the convention for free to look after me and take care of me? And so we said, sure.
Was Miriam his wife?
Oh, no, well, Miriam was his wife, but Miriam died a number of years ago, and Rosalie is his wife now. She's in the counseling department at San Diego State University, all of which is entirely outside meditation, except that Gestalt therapy and meditation are in some ways very close. In fact, the thing that we began, the meditation, what I call the meditation that we began with, that you're saying, right now I am aware of, that's actually often used at the beginning of Gestalt therapy at sessions. Gestalt therapy says essentially therapy takes place out of discovering what is, discovering what's occurring with us, rather than trying to change. I was all early on in my career, I was trained as a behaviorist. All right, you set out or you create a program for change, right? And so I'm intimately familiar with both because I've done Gestalt groups for more than three decades and worked with it. So, but Gestalt therapy is very close to meditation. Occasionally, there are ways in which behavioral processes are valuable in meditation as well. There's something, you discover something, you need to try it out, you need to practice it and work on it. And so they're like the whole psyche. One of the other questions was, where is mind located? Well, mind is located in your body. It's located in your neural cells. The fascinating discovery of mirror neurons in recent years, so that if one person's emotional state tends to set off neurons in another person, being Italians watching monkeys discovered that. In our approach to meditation, my wife and I, everything, we were heavily influenced by Wilhelm Reich, who was the psychoanalyst who was most involved with mind-body experience. We were also heavily influenced by Harish Johari, our own tantric teacher, who was heavily involved in mind-body. So we view everything as located in the body. In somatic experience, there is another meditation that we didn't get to, that's usually part of my starting sequence. That looks like we won't have time for tonight, the way things are going. But In your beginning of you're moving into meditation, I suggest that after paying attention to your breath, after establishing your moving mudra, then take your mind through your body, very explicitly notice any physical tension that you find anywhere, whether it's in your forehead, your jaws, your shoulders, your stomach, your fists, your anus, anywhere. Do a body scan. Notice, is there anything associated with that, that's of a message associated with it that's of value to you? If so, great. Then take note of that message and act on it. And if not, then let go as totally as you can of that physical tension, and do so throughout your body. Then continue your meditation with the least physical tension that you need in order to maintain whatever meditative posture that you're sitting in. Now, I'll tell you a secret now at this point. Everybody has to promise not to tell it to anybody else if I tell it to you. Or you can tell it to one other person, but you can't tell them where you heard it. How many are willing to do that? Well, some are and some won't. Okay. All right. No, I won't tell it to you then. I have to have more agreement than that. Let me take some of these other questions. What is your particular orientation to meditation? I studied Zen for many years. I studied with an Ayurvedic master for many years. I tend to meditate by myself more than in groups, in contrast to someone else here who likes to have someone. Although I must say that one of my principal teachers is the Hugging Mother, Sri Mata Amritananda Mayi, and I love meditating in her groups and love listening to her. She sends me off on all kinds of mental flashes and realizations that I don't have at other times. Many people like having the structure and the guidance. It's actually partly a directing attention. If you have a meditation teacher who is telling you what to do moment by moment, then your mind is less likely to wander. You won't get that to the same extent in classical Zen meditation, because Shikantaza is a highly unstructured mindfulness meditation, but there's still everybody else who is sitting there not moving around you doing the same thing. So there is a kind of a social facilitation which is strong for some people, weak for others. There were questions about how do you get into meditation and how do you keep meditating day by day, and how do you work with resistance to meditating, etc. Well, my suggestion is this. Say to yourself, okay, today I'm going to meditate for at least 2 minutes. And if I can handle it, I'll meditate for 5 minutes. Most people think, oh, 15 minutes, that's going to be grueling. I can't handle 15 minutes. Half an hour, oh my God, an hour? A day? You know, you heard at the beginning of this fellow who meditated all day for days and days and days. But 5 minutes, almost anybody can say, you know, I can handle it. 5 minutes, see what happens, see what comes up. Well, my experience is that practically always, if a person sits down to meditate for 5 minutes, they're likely to want to be there for longer than that before they quit. So that's one good way to begin, is to make a minimal demand on yourself. Consistency is important. Another thing that's important is to say, oh, well, you know, like a lot of people will say, you know, I had a lousy meditation today. It was, you know, I was just sitting there and it was hard to keep sitting there, and thoughts kept coming through my mind. I'm just not making any progress here. Well, what if you have an athlete who takes that kind of an attitude when he or she goes out for the daily practice? The attitude, the athlete goes out and runs, the athlete goes out and lifts or does whatever, and sometimes the running and the lifting feels just great and feels wonderful, and other times it's an effort. Meditation is the same way. You do it consistently. You may miss a day from time to time. However, if you continue to do it over a period of time, it will have positive effects. One person asked, what has meditation done for you personally? Well, it's done several things. One of the things that it has done, I started out as a very intellectual guy. Meditation has helped me become much more intuitive. I started out and still am, basically, you know, people have different kinds of physiological rhythms. Some people are just inherently very centered, very peaceful, very, oh, almost go to sleep with that person, or they're just very, very with you. And I started out life, and still have, as a sort of underlying quality, being a bit of a speedy character. So meditation is a way of slowing down and stopping that speediness. It's a way of becoming here, of being extremely present with another person. Another question was, what does meditation, how can I use meditation for relationships? There is an approach to listening that is called phenomenology, that is in a sense meditating with another person. Phenomenology is the attempt to comprehend another person's experience as fully, as closely as possible to the way it is for them. And every time I notice my own reaction come up, oh yeah, that reminds me of the other day when I, etc., etc., wait a minute, no, that's my crap. That's not hearing you. Let's set that aside. Bring my mind back. Yes, you were saying. And it may be that I go beyond you were saying to you, I think you seem to be feeling, is that right? Checking it out. There are actually several cells that are wonderful helpers in relationships here. There's a cell on love, there's a cell on talking, there's a cell on communication. There are explicit techniques, there are listening techniques, there are techniques that help you be heard when you're talking to another person. So part of it is developing the ability to hear and be heard more effectively. Part of it is it comes back to one of the things that meditation has done for me, is it has helped me develop more heart consciousness, more emotional consciousness. So I guess those are some of the main things for me personally. Let's see. How do you work with resistance? We talked a little about that. Or any other necessary activity, or especially any other necessary activity. That's a huge question. And there are a number of cells here that have very detailed answers to it. One of them is called... Oh, let's see. Well... I guess we didn't actually use the word resistance, but we used the word difficulties. We used the word limits, hang-ups. So there are a spectrum of very explicitly laid out methods of working with resistance that you'll find in some of the cells. Let's see. What's another... Oh, what does matrix in your title mean? Well, we had decided on this kind of a structure. The way we decided on this structure was that in early drafts, we sent some early drafts of the book into our agent, and he said, hey, you know, this has got a lot of good stuff in it, but I just can't quite find my way into it. And my wife had this vision one day of a hand reaching down out of the sky with an unfolding scroll, and the scroll had the looked like that, with everything laid out in that sort of a way, and we thought that's it. And then we began thinking about the variety of different ways in which you could move into it. So what are you going to call it? Are we going to call it a table? That kind of sounds a little dry and academic. Or we just played with words, and matrix was the word that seemed to come out. We like to say that the movie The Matrix is about the matrix of unconsciousness, and this is about the matrix of consciousness. So in a sense, this is the opposite, the mirror image to the movie The Matrix, although there are some people in the movie who are trying to move toward consciousness too. And I think that answers most of the questions. This is poignant. This one about relationships and part of what you will inevitably discover, or are inevitably in the process of discovering, particularly in reflective meditations. In the reflective meditations, there are portions of your past that will come before your eyes, or come into your heart or your mind, and you'll say, "My God, I did that. No wonder she left me. No wonder she walked out on me." And you begin to I discovered things that I had done in the past that I perceived in a very different light, that I was deaf and blind to aspects of what I was doing at the time that I was doing them. But they bubble up during meditation, and they bubble up with an awareness of them in a different way that provides a transformation in the way I am with another person in the world, which has to do with this next question: what is spiritual transformation, and what does it have to do with meditation? Well, spiritual transformation, there are many ways to say it, and there are many words that we can put around it. One of the essential elements of it is that you are in touch with your own deep inner spirit, and moving and acting from that place, rather than moving and acting in response to all of the pressures that are coming around you from society and from other people and from all sides. Another is expressed by a variety of words. Buddha talked about moving from samsara to nirvana, the samsara being the world of illusion, nirvana being being where you can see things clearly, where you can perceive what actually is. Moving away, most of us walk through the world with a screen of words and concepts between us and the world that we actually see. What do you see here? What does anybody see?
Beauty.
Okay, that's fairly abstract. Let's get closer, more concrete. What do you see?
Flowers.
Flowers. Okay, we've got beauty at this level of abstraction up here. One of the things we do with meditation is get down in our levels to the concrete, like the Zen expression of finger pointing at the moon. Right, the finger is not the moon itself. So we've got, and you see flowers. So I'll take the flower and I'll smell it, and I'll kind of rub my cheek against it, and feel the sensuousness of it. And all of a sudden, there's no screen of concepts between me and that at all. There is just the sensation, there is just the experience right there. So that's part of spiritual transformation, is becoming able to be extremely present. Another part of it, in Zen, Shinryu Suzuki used the term big mind and small mind. The common, the everyday language, large-mindedness and small-mindedness. You know what that is. Well, large-minded is moving from being small-minded to being large-minded is spiritual transformation. Moving from being selfish to being generous is spiritual transformation. Moving from being greedy or hateful toward being loving is spiritual transformation. You all know what it is. Sometimes you cause yourself to forget. We all fall under the spell of, back to psychology, the principle of immediate reinforcement. An immediate reinforcer has a stronger and more powerful effect on behavior than a delayed reinforcer. So I do something that gets me what I want right now, even though it has terrible long-term effects on me or on other people. Spiritual transformation is being able to recognize that, to see it all, and I don't need to do that. Spiritual transformation is being, I think of the non-babas. In India, there is a religious festival. I'm 5 minutes over time. Can
please?
How many more minutes can I have?
You may have 7 more minutes.
7 more minutes. Great. Wow. Thank you.
Or 8. It's in a good mood tonight.
The largest festival in the world, religious festival in the world, is not the pilgrimage to Mecca. It is the Kumbh Mela in India. It's a Hindu festival. It happens once every 3 years. There are four different places in which it's located. My wife and I went to the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad in 2001, and it's like the in the summer the Ganges River becomes very small. There, like. Millions of people. A temporary city is built for millions of people. The Indian Army comes in and puts pontoon bridges across the river, like 17,000 miles of electrical cable and power cable were strung for the thing. It is mind-boggling. It is said that on the peak bathing day, that like if you bathe in the Ganges at the Kumbh Mela on the peak bathing day, all of your sins are washed away. So my wife and I did that. We went actually with a wealthy friend of ours who hired a boat, and so instead of being crushed by the hordes that were on the shore, we went and got out of the boat into the Ganges out in the middle of the river, and I just dived in, and people said, he's going to drown! I happen to be a scuba diver and a very strong swimmer, so there was, you know, no big problem. But at any rate, we have only the sins to our credit, which we have incurred since 2001, I'm happy to say. But at the Kumbh Mela, one of the groups of participants is yogis that seldom come out into the public that are called Nag Babas. And the Nag Babas go absolutely naked. Too bad I don't have pictures with me or a little presentation. But they are covered with ashes. They look kind of bluish because they're covered with ash and have various markings on their face. And their only possession is one metal pail, a little metal pail that they can use to put food in, water in, whatever else it is. And it is the anti-materialistic statement. Yeah, the ultimate anti-materialistic statement. It is a statement that says, I need nothing other than myself and what I can do with my hands and the encounters I can make with people, and I can go through the world like this. I know one person in the United States who did that here. Walked across barefoot across from New York to Los Angeles. A brilliant man, had gone to Harvard in biochemistry, something rather of the sort. But you know, has that kind of consciousness. So spiritual. That's another kind of spiritual transformation. Yet another kind of spiritual transformation is the multi millionaire who says, this is. I'm going to devote the rest of my life to doing good things for people. I feel, you know, that's what my heart needs. That's what's good for the world. So there's a spiritual transformation is not, you can think of it as an arrow. And if you go deeply inside yourself and if you notice the walls and the prejudices and the rigidities that separate from you from other people, you'll be able to feel it. You see a beautiful sunrise in the morning or sunset in the afternoon and the evening, and you say, you know, this is what I want my life to be. I want my life to be like a sunset, rainbow, or sunrise. And what do I need to do that? That's spiritual transformation. I think I've dealt with most of your questions. Is there any last comment or wondering? I feel bad because I really haven't told you a lot about what I think is an utterly wonderful book here, and certainly urge you to have a look at it, and urge you to take it home, and I think you will find that it becomes a companion that will keep you good company possibly for the rest of your life. It's something that you can pick up and read 5 minutes at a time. And it says a 16-week program. It can be a 16-day program. It can be a 16-year program. It can be totally timeless. Thank you for being with me here today.